Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to K20, but we'll call it a pre-K-12 education talk radio show today, Wednesday, March 4th, 2015. My name's Larry Jacobs. As mentioned, K-12 Education Talk Radio, K-20. Thank you for listening. I say K-20 because we have our guest today from NCTE, Kathleen Blake Yancey, who is a very distinguished professor at the University of Florida in warm, I hope it's warm, we'll find out from Kathleen, Tallahassee, Florida, and also in regarding this show today, the chair of the NCTE Task Force on Assessment. And she's also a former NCTE president, and we're honored to have her here. And we'll be bringing her on in just a second. So hang tight, Dr. Yancey, and we'll bring you on. We're going to archive the show at education-talkradio.org, tweet it out at EduTalkRadio. By the way, I'm a little cloggy today, in case you can't hear that. I have a terrible head cold, so bear with me if I cough and hack or snuffle a little bit. As I say, it's March, and I live in Maine. What are you going to do? And my wife had it last week. Let's blame her. Okay? So we're going to archive the show, education-talkradio.org. Tweet it out at EduTalkRadio. And today's show is sponsored by the Great Books Foundation, our good friends, strong supporters, NCTE. They are the independent nonprofit educational organization whose mission is to empower readers of all ages to become more reflective thinkers. There's an idea through the discussion of written works and ideas of enduring value. They offer educators a wide range of literary anthologies and nonfiction materials, other classroom products that empower K-12 students to become independent readers and thinkers. I think it's wonderful. Schools that integrate Great Books Foundation materials and their, quote, shared inquiry method of learning into their curriculum create school success and student success by improving the students' critical thinking, reading comprehension, writing, speaking, and listening skills, part of the standards, Common Core, whatever you want to call them. It's important. Please find out more. Greatbooks.org, greatbooks.org, and they tweet at GreatBooksFND. Great Books FND, and as I say, we already tweeted out at EduTalk Radio. I know my pals at NCTE, which tweets at NCTE, is doing the same thing. Let me bring on Dr. Yancey. Good morning, Kathleen. It's Larry Jacobs.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
Well, I'm just fine. The well-distinguished Kellogg W. Hunt Professor of English and distinguished research professor over at FSU. How's the weather in Tallahassee today?
Finally, the weather in Tallahassee is good. I honestly can't complain because the rest of the country had terrible weather, I know, and is continuing to have bad weather. But we did; it was pretty chilly for us and very cloudy. You don't want clouds in Florida too much. But it's this week the sun has returned, the warm temperatures have returned, and so life is good.
I'm glad to hear that. We all hate you. Thank you for this interview. That was just great.
That's terrific. We survived to give you a target.
Yeah, nobody wants to hear. It's just nuts out there. We had another 3 inches of snow last night, but it's supposed to go up to 42 here in Maine today, and then I'm sure it'll all freeze
that's
again.
That's the problem, isn't it? Because it's gonna flood, isn't it?
No, what's going to happen eventually? There's going to be the runoff from the mountains. All right, and there will be. I don't know whether it's going to be flooding per se here, but the rivers are going to be pretty nutty for a while. All right,
yeah,
hopefully it won't flood
California.
Yeah. It's just wild up here. What a crazy winter. I'm glad it's March. I'm glad it's over. And be happy you're in Tallahassee.
I will be.
Yes.
Until July. In July, nobody wants to be here.
That's true. I feel horrible for your suffering. I feel terrible. Yeah. Actually, I lived in Florida. It is pretty gruesome in the summer. But at least it's quiet. And you can get around and do stuff. There's no tourists and that sort of thing.
That's exactly right.
And I might add, not many students at the university. It's a little bit of a pleasure right then and there. Take it for what it's worth, okay? The assessment. You're the ex-president of NCTE. Okay, are you still?
I'm one of many. That's correct.
Yes, yes, you are. And I think isn't your you're emblazoned on one of our coins? Are you not?
Yeah, I wish, and I'm collecting them. Please send them to me.
Right, I will. I will. No problem. I think we found one with a metal detector the other day. All
right. Right.
And how long ago were you, Kathleen? How long ago were you president?
2008.
Oh, that's just that's nothing.
That's nothing. That's exactly right.
It's still there. Are you still in line like the like where you go with the president, president emeritus, all that sort of thing? Are you back or are you off the chart there?
See, I don't think so. We don't actually have an emeritus status, and I think if they gave it to us, then they wouldn't get any more work out of us. So I think what they do is they keep you alive as past president, and when new tasks come up, like this one on the assessment task force,
yeah.
Then they ask you if you want to get back into harness, and some of us like to get back into harness. So
it's
a lucky
fun,
person, and this is a great project. So.
And it is a great project, and I can only imagine, if I may, now I hope you'll tell me I'm wrong here, the aggravation of being on the not being on the task force on assessment, but learning how it's so rough to I'm assuming this, you're going to give us the facts, that it's so rough to teach these days with the emphasis so much on assessment. And I'll bet dollars to donuts that's what you're hearing these days. So let's start off at the beginning. Tell us about the assessment story research project, which your group is doing. And by the way, if people just Google NCTE assessment story research, it'll pop right up for you. Okay, just so everybody knows that. Kathleen, you're on. Well, what is this thing?
Well, that's a great question, and we would love to hear from the really more people. The more, the merrier. Last summer, the NCTE Executive Committee and the presidential team formed this assessment task force, and they did so in anticipation of there being the attention to standardized testing, to Common Core, to various state tests. There are changes that are occurring in the SAT forthcoming. So there's a lot of activity around testing. And so, the leadership of NCTE formed this task force to have us think with the council about how we understand assessment and what our view of assessment is and how assessment can be used to help students and teachers who are working with students. In the course of developing some talking points, doing an environmental scan, and getting a much better grasp of the myriad of activities that are going on in the world of tests, one thing became pretty clear. We hadn't actually heard from teachers. Teachers who are the ones, you know, who are in some cases giving the tests, in other cases walking their students down the hall so that they can sit in a computer classroom and take the tests. And we thought, well, we should hear from them, and we should especially hear from them because this is the moment when a lot of new tests are being put into play. So what actually does it look like on the ground? And nobody had ever asked teachers that, not in any large-scale way.
Right.
So that's the assessment story project. It's a short survey. It doesn't take too long. It does allow people to identify the kind of school that they work in, and we've heard from kindergarten teachers to college teachers. We do want a little bit of information about whether it's a so-called high-performing school, whether it's got a lot of socioeconomic needs. And then basically we just have five questions, and we want to hear from teachers about how assessment is impacting their classroom and how it's impacting their teaching and how it's impacting their students. So three units of analysis. And then the last thing I'll say is that we don't have a particular brief here. If everyone who filled out the survey said, you know, these assessments are so helpful, it's really transformed our teaching, and the data that we're getting, those data really help us help our kids, then that's what we'd be reporting out. So it's not leading the witness. It's really trying to learn from teachers about what's actually going on.
Can you give us a hint as to what you're hearing so far?
I sure can. No, it's just fascinating. It's good news, bad news. There is as much assessment activity as you might expect, though I will say that the teachers make a real distinction between what they call testing and what they call assessment. testing, and we have over 200 teachers now who have responded. And as I say, across all educational levels and across the country as well. And they're very clear that from their point of view, testing is something that interrupts and assessment is something that supports. So
I like that. I have to stop you and ask you a question. Do you find that they're really making that distinction between tests? I think you are, but I just want to make that clear because I think what you just said is very, very important. All right?
In any number of quotes, that's their language.
Let me ask it the other way. Is administration clear about that? Is administration clear about the difference?
No, I'm fairly certain they're not, and I can imagine why. There is an argument to be had that if a test is a very good test, then it should inform instruction, and there are people who will say that it should drive instruction. And what the teachers are saying is that no matter how you might define a good test, the tests that their students are taking are not good. And that assessment, which they understand is a fundamentally different enterprise, we might talk about what this distinction is separating those two, and that an assessment activity is an activity that really can support students. So one thing is, from their point of view, a test is external. It's imposed by someone else. They don't have any input into it. Including what's in the test, the form that the test takes, the time that the test is given, the results that are provided, often in the next school year.
Exactly. Thank you. Exactly.
Have gone on someplace else. If they get any data, at all. Now, some of them do get data. And I, for example, there was one teacher I thought that was very interesting. But let me get back to assessment. So assessment, in contrast, is something that is embedded in the classroom, it's contextualized in the classroom, it's part of the student's learning, and it's used on a daily basis to figure out where each kid is and to tailor the learning to support that kid. Those are very different models. And I'll say there was one teacher who talked about, she said, we have a lot of data, and she said that she had correlated the data between what she had seen in her own classroom assessments and what the standardized test had showed her, and she said that 85% of what she saw was exactly what the standardized test told her, and her question was, if the correlation is that high, why do I need the test?
Bingo. Yeah. Well, I know it's a rhetorical question. You have the same answer I do, because it's being required by people who need some form of data and numbers to quantify something. But it's really, but it's for them. It's not about the students. I that's the only way I can kind of explain it.
Well, in their defense, I think they'll say that it will help students. And I also, in the best of all instances, we should assume that everyone here is a person of goodwill. And I think that people would say, they understand that there are problems, that they can't get the data back sooner, or that there are mistakes and they can't be helped. For example, in the state of Florida right now, kids are being given tests on the computers, and the computers are all shutting down. So now, in Leon County, which is where I am, they've just decided to put off the test until they can assure that the technology will work. The bad news is that if the technology works, then nobody's going to get to go into the computer classrooms to do any learning. They're going to spend, several weeks there doing nothing but testing, which is, it's a side effect. It's collateral damage is the way you might think about it.
Unintended consequences. You know what you need? You need everybody who's assigning these standardized tests to read Catch 22, Joseph Heller's novel.
Exactly.
That would clear it up fairly quickly. Yeah, major
I think
can
it
only
would.
See
it
you
would
when he's not in.
Frame, wouldn't
yeah.
it? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
And this is very. I'm using all these literary things. This is very. You got me going here with English. This is very Kafkaesque. I have to tell you, this is nuts.
It is Kafkaesque. It's there. You know, and in fact, actually, what's really, you know, just in thinking about this phone call this morning, one and going over some of what the teachers have told us, one of the things that struck me is that in this particular landscape, education becomes the workaround. You know, a workaround being a strategy that you use because the strategy you're supposed to use doesn't work. So in this case, the strategy that, I mean, what we should be doing is helping kids learn, and what we're really doing is testing them so that education and assessment becomes the workaround when the test has basically subsumed the curriculum.
And you know, one of the things, Kathleen, maybe you know a little bit about this. I don't know, in your position over at the Florida State, distinguished research professor, New York State, and I've always said this, New York State has been using the Regents, which is a standardized test, for years.
Right. Yeah.
But their education system, if I may, and I'm just kind of stereotyping here, seems to work. All right? Because there's a correlation somewhere, in however it all worked out, it seems to me, and maybe you can correct me, between what the teachers are literally teaching, what the kids are learning, and how the test is created. It seems to work. But
well,
you don't seem to be learning. Help me out here, because I always, maybe you can help me with that. I'll make
sure.
It in the
no,
form
that,
of the
I mean,
question. Yeah.
I would agree with you in the sense that the test matches the curriculum, which I think is the point you're making, and that's another issue with the Common Core, is that
right.
It's not clear that the curriculum or the professional development that was, you know, you would think would accompany the curriculum has caught up with the test. So that's, you know, that's not the issue with the Regents, where there is close alignment between the test and it is very much part of the educational culture of the state. I would agree with you there. But I would point out that even the Regents has not been without its problems. You may remember, this was within the last 10 years, but it may have been as long as 10 years ago, there was a big brouhaha because the literature on the excerpts of literature that were used on the Regents had been bolderized. Which is actually a term that comes from the 19th century, referring mm-hmm. to texts that have been cleaned up because they're too dangerous or risque. And I don't know if you remember that, but I got a lot of coverage.
I remember that phrase. Yeah. I don't remember the instance. The instance with the Regents, but I know the word bulbarized.
I can send you and our listeners the
You are the English professor. I love this. Go ahead.
Well, it was fascinating because in school the kids got to read the full text, and then when they got to the time to take the test, you know, it wasn't the full text any longer. So I don't think there's any test we can find where there isn't some kind of problem. The second point I'd make is that the Regents is basically, like other standardized tests, not something that allows you to get a very full picture of a student's learning. And that's what we hear from the teachers, is that they're all about assessment. They're actually assessment practitioners in their classrooms, but they want an assessment practice that actually helps students on, you know, as a routine matter, not, you know, one anxiety-filled moment that tends to distort the learning process.
Well, it is so complicated, and I feel bad for teachers these days with all this coming down. And you know, what's interesting, you have something, and I like this with the English teachers, all right, portfolio assessment. Now, we're not talking about testing yet, we're talking about assessment.
That's
okay,
right.
What's portfolio? Yeah, well, tell me about portfolio assessment, what you're hearing from the world's English teachers so far.
Well, I was astonished. We didn't ask them about, you know, we were not leading the witness. We didn't say, so tell us about portfolio assessment. We asked them what their own practices were and what, if any, alternatives did they see to standardized tests. And almost half, 47% of the elementary school teachers whose responses we picked up oh gosh, something like 70 responses between yesterday and today. So I haven't had a chance to look at those.
But great.
Oh, it's great. It's wonderful. As of yesterday, I think it was 47% of elementary school teachers were using portfolios, a little over 50 for middle school, a little more than that for high school, and then up to 70% of the college respondents. So you know right away that in terms of our respondents, half or better of them are using portfolio assessment. That's point one. Point two is that portfolios are not, and this is so interesting, portfolios are not new. Math teachers and writing teachers in the late 1980s were developing portfolio assessment for their classrooms. So this is a practice that it seems there's almost been a quiet revolution, if you will, about portfolios. People haven't paid a whole lot. I mean, they paid a lot of attention to them when they were first out, and they got a lot of attention in the 90s. And we can talk about lots of different kinds of attention. And then it's just, you know, they've just been naturalized. They're just sort of normalized. People don't talk about them very much. They just do them. It seems that portfolios in this quiet revolution have become a part of the social fabric of the classroom. Now, they're not always used the same way. You know, obviously, what you're asking a second grader to do may not be what you're asking a 10th grader to do, but it has become part of classroom practice. And a portfolio, as we know, it basically is defined by three features. It's a collection of work. And it's a selection of a larger subset. So let's say in a marking period in high school, marking period, you know, goes on for about a quarter of the year usually. And it might be that the students have written, let's say, five substantial pieces. They may choose two of those and write a reflection, and that's the third component. So collection, selection, reflection. Write a reflection. We can talk about what role that plays or what questions students are grappling with. And then all of that comes in together as a package. I will also say that it's not uncommon when it comes in as a package that the two formal pieces that students are including come in as a set of drafts. So you can see how the drafts changed over time. You literally can see a kind of change and development that you really can't see in a single episode of testing. And you, of course, can see, you know, how the student does on more than one task, which is, especially in writing, very important because we know how important genre is. The fact that Shakespeare could write a sonnet, which he certainly could do, and the fact that he could write a play, which he certainly could do, doesn't actually mean that he could write a web text today. My point being that there are, right there, you know, the fact that you can do well in one genre doesn't mean you can do well in another, and a portfolio allows you to see that, and therefore it allows you to target your instruction.
And is it? Let me ask this question then. Portfolios seem to work. The teachers seem to like them. So what's the problem? Is it that they're too subjective? That every teacher will look at it differently?
When you score them, they're not. I mean, the way you respond to the question about reliability. When you say, are they too subjective, what that means is, I take that to mean that there's a concern that if you looked at one portfolio, you might think it was wonderful, and I might look at it and think it was terrible. That's what subjectivity seems to mean. And in assessment language, that's a concern for reliability, meaning that we will consistently score it according to the same benchmarks and come up with the same score. And there are mechanisms for doing that. And honestly, there are several college programs. Carleton College is among the best known, where faculty come together every year. And these are faculty across the discipline, by the way, so not just writing faculty. So people who are teaching very different things come together, and they score their portfolios very consistently. Washington State University has done this. Eckerd University has done this. And, in fact, Washington State and Eckerd College in Florida have done it so well that they've gotten commendations from their accrediting agencies. So you can we can address that. The question about why it hasn't, why has portfolio assessment not become the assessment of choice. Is that really what you're asking?
Yeah, basically I am.
So that's a great question. It was, in the state of Kentucky, it was the assessment of choice. For quite some time, it was connected to the so-called CURA Act, which provided more money for schools, and then they wanted a more rigorous assessment, and portfolios was that provided the mechanism of choice. The concern with portfolio, there are people who, regardless of the scoring, have concerns about reliability. That's one issue. A second issue is that if you think about a multiple choice test, and I'm sorry to say it, I wish it weren't so, but there are still many, if not most, tests of writing that are multiple choice.
Really?
Oh yeah, they are.
Really?
Oh yes. Oh yes, they are. As a matter of fact. And
no comment. I won't even comment on that one.
Well, and you can think what is cheaper, having students fill out bubbles, running it through a Scantron, or actually bringing people together, and I mean people together, not robo-graders, but human beings to look at writing. That it's more expensive. I mean, there's no question. I would point out that we do get what we pay for. And if your concept of writing is located in a bubble test, you will get something that's cheap, and you'll be sorry you didn't spend a little more money. So that's another concern. A third concern that people will raise is that, and this is sort of, I mean, somewhat ironic, I think, is that in portfolio assessment, you'll actually see the student. Whereas if you think of a bubble test, you won't see the student because the student is represented in a bunch of bubbles.
By his bubble, by his or her bubble.
Right. I mean, you can't distinguish between two students on the basis of...
Actually, the only way you could distinguish if it was if you were actually testing Mr. Bubble.
That's correct. That's
the bubble bath. Right.
Yeah. That's it. And, and what happens in a single episode of testing is that students will often reveal something depending on the nature of the topic and so forth. But it's not when you get to the more you look at, the more distinctive the human being will be. There's no question. But if assessment is actually intended to help students learn, that would be a benefit. That would not be a liability.
Well, you just took the next line right out. I wrote this down 2 seconds ago. We're talking about testing, but the goal is not testing. The goal is learning. It's about learning, not testing.
Right.
It's not about saving money. It's not about bubbles versus non-bubbles. It's about learning.
That's correct. So
yeah, and we've lost. It seems to me we've lost a little track of that somewhere along the way.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. But what's interesting to me is how much of that we seem to have lost. And there is a perception on the part of more than one teacher from the Assessment Story Project that there's a lot of money being spent on these tests, and that the money is basically being used to enrich textbook publishers and test makers. And it's a very interesting question.
And also, I might add, I don't want to come down hard on anybody, but also it's supporting the people who are asking all those people to create the tests.
Sure, you betcha. You betcha.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a job saver. Oh, yeah, I called the ABC publishing company, and oh, yeah, I got that together, and this is what we got, and I'm off the hook.
Sure.
Okay? And what you're doing, they don't ask the teachers.
Other thing is that, it's interesting. So if you're somebody interested in assessment, and so you're thinking about, well, what are the criteria that we will use to help us decide which assessment we'll use? And if you put at the top of your list of criteria, this assessment should help students, I would submit to you that you'd get a very different answer in terms of which assessment or which test should you use than we are currently getting. But whether or not the assessment will actually help learners, if it makes the list at all, is so far down the list, de facto, it just doesn't count.
And I have to ask, are you at the School of Education? down in
Tallahassee? No, I'm not. I'm in an English department. Though I have, I mean, we work very closely with our colleagues in English Ed, in any number of ways, I should say.
Okay, so you're not teaching future teachers, or I know you're not teaching that much right now, but are you?
Well, I teach future teachers in college. Believe me,
yeah,
all
that's
the time.
What I mean. That's what I mean.
Oh yeah.
So you're
I
teaching.
Do.
You're in contact then with the Department of Education at Florida State. Okay.
Oh yeah.
So my question is, knowing all this, and you're popping out English teachers and other kinds of teachers as well. Okay,
sure.
You're doing English. Okay, are they changing the way they teach the future teachers at the college level? We'll just use FSU as the example. Okay, are they changing the way that they're teaching them to teach and assess based on all this stuff that's going on right now, or are they still spitting out? No offense to that word, the same type of thing that we were 10 years ago. Spitting out's a bad word. I apologize for that phrase.
Sure. No. But I understand the spirit of the query.
Yeah.
You know, practice varies. So let me give you three quick ways to think about it. I think on our campus at Florida State University, mm-hmm. What we do is, In fact, I can tell you quite definitively that we want future teachers to be aware of what the landscape looks like relative to assessment and testing.
Right.
We want
right.
them to know enough that they can talk back to it, and they can engage in best practices in their own classrooms. And in fact, my colleague Michael Neal and I were sufficiently concerned that some of our students did not have this information, that we offered a special 3-day institute on writing assessment a year and a half ago. That
wow.
we did, you know, not, I mean, we did it in May, we did it when students were not taking classes, and it was an entirely devoted to helping them understand all of this, because we think it's so important, and we did it for free. It's not part of our teaching load. So we're totally in favor of this. We want them to be able to do, you know, as I say, what's best for their students, and also understand, it's very important that you understand the larger landscape. Then you understand you're not alone. It's not just your district. It's not just your building. It's not just your state, that there are, you know, there are other players who are active in this. But I will say that in the data that we've seen, in the Assessment Story Project data, we had one or two teachers did say that they were disappointed because the student teachers who were working in their classrooms are so oriented to the test that they seem to have lost sight of what the curriculum is.
Mm.
And that's a problem. And I'll also say
That kind of sums up what I was asking.
Exactly.
Actually,
and
here's
the third part. There's another dimension to this. And here I'm thinking of some work that's been done by Randy Bomer, who is another past president of National Council of Teachers of English, and
mm-hmm.
he teaches down at University of Texas at Austin. He gave a paper a couple years back that was disturbing, I would say, in its observations that pre-service teachers that he was seeing on his campus had been shaped by the tests themselves. So now, if that's true, if you put those two things together, if it's an accurate portrayal, then what you have is a group of students whose own sense of writing and reading has been formed by testing, who then are going to be operating as teachers themselves. And that's a problem. I mean, I will say at Florida, we, in fact, with two of my colleagues, we Kara Tozek and Leanne Robertson, we just published a book last spring called Writing Across Contexts, Transfer, Composition, and Sites of Writing. And I mention that because we interviewed a number of students coming to Florida State. And that, you know, the students would say things. The students are wonderful. Don't get me wrong. I'm not bashing students. I love them. They were terrific. And they are terrific. I mean, they're just, you can't be a teacher without students. So I know where my priorities are.
Right.
But I'll also say that when you ask them about their understanding of writing, we had any number of students who would say, oh, writing, I know what writing is. Writing is FCAT writing. FCAT is our state exam.
Yeah, Florida Comprehensive, yeah.
That's right.
Wow.
Although now it's changing. It's going to be, now it's the FSA. But, I mean, it's you know, you can change its clothes. It's the same thing.
Yeah, right.
Right. And
that's a major change.
They had no sense of writing process. And that now you're back to the Regents exam, right? There's no sense of writing process because that's not what the test permits. So there's no sense of revision. You don't see how students, whether or not students can use sources of their own, because that's not built into the model. Many, if not, you know, most of the moves that writers make, you cannot get in a single episode of testing. And so not only do students come out with no process as a result of this, but they think that this is the only way of writing. They think FCAT writing is the equivalent of writing. So what happens when they come to us after being, you know, held hostage in the system, basically, what we have to do is help them understand writing in completely different ways.
You know, the old industrial system created the current school districts, current school system to fit people into factories and agriculture. And we're doing the same thing. We're putting out the cogs to fit into wheels.
It's really
not very good. And I know you're what, you're 29 years old, but I'm got 40 years on you almost in that case.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Okay?
Finally.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. And I'm sure you could be my great granddaughter if that were the case. But you know,
I look forward to that.
I get you a present on your birthday. I'm starting to go senile, but other than that, it's working out.
I won't let you forget.
But you know, when you've got teachers who were trained the old way prior to this assessment and the FCATs, and then looking at the way they want to measure kids. The whole thing is just out of it's just wild. So we got about 2 minutes left, Kathleen. Where do you want this to go? Let's say you get that report all together. Okay,
yeah.
What happens next? You give it to Millie and say, get this out there, Millie, over at NCC.
Well, we're actually
because Millie's not busy.
Millie is not busy.
She could stamp every envelope herself if need be. I just want to make that point. She's not busy at all.
Talking to you is a great way of getting it out. There was some coverage of the project in Ed Week yesterday. NCTE is sponsoring Advocacy Day in Washington, D.C. Tomorrow, and people will be taking different parts of this and sharing it with members of Congress and their staff. Survey is going to be open until April. We're going to continue to collect data as tests continue to roll out. A good piece of news is that in spite of all the things we've said, teachers are engaging in assessment that is actually helping students. So we might find ways to think about that and to talk about how we might scale that up so that it actually made a difference. And we could move away from the single episode of testing to an assessment that supports kids.
Here's your next book, Student Learning in the Age of Bubbles.
Oh, I love it.
Take it.
You got a credit.
It's Student Learning in the Age of Bubbles. I love it. Okay.
I love it, too.
It's wow. Well, good luck with this, Kathleen. Okay.
Well, thank
Good
you
luck.
So much, Larry. This has just been
this
great.
Was fun.
I really enjoyed this.
Thank you. I wish you were my professor when I was in school in 1847.
Well, listen, if you want to come back, let me know. We've always got a place for you.
Oh, thank you. That's a Seminole.
There you
right?
go. That's it.
I'll leave it
there?
At that. Okay. Kathleen, thanks a million. You have a great day. And now
thank
the weather's
you
getting
too,
warmer. Stay warm. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Woo. The Graves stole that from the Seminoles, just in case nobody knows that. Okay, Florida State. All right, and then the Atlanta Braves I was talking about. Kathleen Blake Yancey, Florida State professor. Kellogg W. Hunt, professor of English and distinguished research professor. And she's a chair of the NCTE Task Force on Assessment and former NCTE president. And if you just Google Assessment Story Research Project, NCTE, it'll take you right over to there. And I did Google that. I want to make one point here. Let me find it here. That there is Wednesday, March 4th, which is today. I know a lot of people listen on the archives, but if listening today, at 8 o'clock tonight, NCTE on-air event. You got to go over to this Assessment Story Project blog over at ncte.org, and there's a link you can click right on through, and you can listen to this. They've collected some great things that will reassert what we just did, so you can listen to that, tell your friends, etc. There's all kinds of stuff over there. Again, Assessment Story Project at ncte.org. They tweet at NCTE. We tweet at EduTalk Radio. We'll tweet out a direct link to the show when we're done. Please follow us. We'll put an archive up at education-talkradio.org. Again, let me thank my good friends over at Great Books Foundation. Speaking of reading and thinking and all those sort of things, offer educators a wide range of literature anthologies, nonfiction materials, other classroom products that empower K-12 students to become independent readers and thinkers. Now, there's an idea. Okay, schools that integrate their shared inquiry method of learning into their curriculum create school success by improving students' critical thinking, reading comprehension, writing, speaking, and listening. No bubbles. Okay, no bubbles. Greatbooks.org, Great Books Foundation, greatbooks.org. They tweet at greatbooksfnd. My name is Larry Jacobs. This is K-12 Education Talk Radio. Kathleen, thank you. Great Books, thank you. Millie Davis over at NCTE, thank you. Everybody have a great day. I'm going to go take an Alka-Seltzer cold and cough. Thanks for listening.